stars next to it, like a restaurant. So I clicked on the reviews, and one of them said, this is like a spa for theoretical physicists. And that's how I feel too, so thanks for having me here. So this is a talk about the quantum entropy power inequality. This is joint work with Graham Smith, and I haven't given this talk before, so I hope it will be more or less clear, but what you see here is essentially an illustration of the proof of this kind of inequality, and I will explain this in more detail later. So what's the motivation for considering this kind of inequalities? Well, the goal here is to say something about continuous variable classical or quantum channels. So in particular, so-called additive noise channels. So what's an additive noise channel? It takes an input x, and it outputs something called x plus y. And this y is sort of locally generated. You should think of this as the environment. And it interacts with this addition operation that I'll specify in more detail later on. And we would like to understand the capacity of such a channel. And just to give you two basic examples, I will explain this in more detail later on, but these are special cases that have received quite a lot of attention, partly because they're sort of physically relevant, and also they're mathematically more accessible than, say, the general case. So on the left, this is the case of a white Gaussian additive noise channel. This is a classical channel where the environment is just a normal random variable, so a random variable Gaussian distribution. And the quantum analog of that is the case where the environment is in a thermal state, in a Gibbs state of a quadratic Hamiltonian. And so these are just two special cases. What's special here is that we really know the structure of this environment. And but in this talk, I would like to tell you a few things about a more general case where we don't really know the form of y, but we only have, say, a bound on the entropy of y. And that's what entropy power inequalities achieve. Okay, so this is a short outline of the talk. I will tell you about the known classical results, the classical entropy power inequality. Then I will give you a formulation of a quantum version of that. And I will only very briefly show you that this actually has applications. And most of the talk will be spent explaining the proof of this kind of inequality. And as you'll see, the proof is essentially a classical argument. But if you do it the right way, you get a proof of the quantum statement. And I will just point out at the end of the talk what we have to modify to get proof of the quantum entropy power inequality. Okay, so let me start with classical information. And well, this is very basic, so just a few definitions. So we're considering random variables on the real line or on Rn, and they're specified by probability density functions, like so. And what we want to define is some addition law. So we have two independent random variables with certain distributions that go into this interaction, and what comes out is over there. Of course, this is defined in the way you would expect. You just take the convolution of these distributions. And then this output, we call that x plus y. So that's pretty simple. It's sort of a bit unnatural if you think about the physical channel, because here there's a symmetry between the environment and the input. So in general, we might want to vary the strength of this interaction and control how much of the environment is in this output. So to do that, we have to define rescaled random variables, so we can just rescale the distribution, sort of stretch it out. And then we can introduce a parameter that I call the transmissivity, and that can be between 0 and 1. And we'll just say that this new addition law, it outputs square root of lambda times x plus square root of 1 minus lambda times y. So this parameter lambda sort of parameterizes how strong this interaction is. So in other words, you get a whole family of such addition laws, and what I showed you previously essentially corresponds to the case where lambda is equal to a half. Okay. And just to shorten the notation, I will call this x plus y with the subscript lambda. So the entropy power inequality tells you something about the entropy of this output in terms of the entropy of the inputs. So more precisely, it has to do with so-called entropy powers. So let me define these quantities. Again, this is extremely standard. So we have the variance of a random variable. We have the entropy, so-called differential entropy in this continuous case. And of course, these are not independent. For example, in the case of a Gaussian distribution, the distribution is completely specified by the variance. In particular, you can compute the entropy as a function of the variance. So let me invert this relation. We can express the variance as a function of the entropy. And the reason why I'm doing this is to introduce the notion of entropy power. So now we're just going to call the right-hand side of this the entropy power of a random variable. So that's the definition. It's just a very simple function of the entropy of the random variable. And in the Gaussian case, it corresponds to the variance. And the variance is known classically or sometimes referred to as the power of the signal. That's where the name comes from. So for a general random variable, it is simply, this quantity is simply the power of a Gaussian distribution that has the same entropy as C. And well, just a quick remark, this quantity has to do with estimation. There's an analog of Fanos inequality, which gives you a lower bound on the estimation error in terms of this entropy power. But we're not really going to use this. I just wanted to introduce this quantity. And now we can state the entropy power inequality, the classical one. What it says is that the average entropy power of these inputs, x and y, so that's what you see on the left-hand side, this average entropy power is a lower bound on the output entropy power. So that's a maybe a pretty strange looking inequality if you're, if you've seen other things in information theory, it's not of the usual kind. But I'll show you a version that might look a little bit more familiar. So you should think of this as some kind of concativity of this quantity, the entropy power, with respect to this additional. So this is just the case for equal lambda equals a half. So we have equal transmissivity for x and y. And this kind of inequality was first proposed by Shannon, but his arguments weren't quite complete. Complete proof was given by Stamm, later simplified by Blachmann, and Baron made this more rigorous. So there's kind of a long history, and by now there are at least 10 different proofs of this kind of inequality, but many of them revolve around the same ideas. So essentially there are two different kinds of proofs. I will not talk too much about applications, partly because I don't know what all of these are. Let me just say that this kind of inequality gives upper bound on capacities. So you can get converse results to various rate regions. So you, and the reason, if you think about this, and you've seen talks about minimum output entropy and so on, it's clear that this kind of inequality gives you a lower bound on the output entropy of this kind of channel. And that's sort of the connection to capacities. And I will give you a little bit of information about the quantum case later on, about an application in that case. Okay, so let me just give you a different version of this. So I told you the written version gives you a statement on the entropy powers. But in fact, the same kind of thing is true for the entropies. So the average entropy of these inputs is a lower bound on the output entropy. And again, I should stress here that x and y are independent random variables, and we combine them using this convolution or addition law. So this looks pretty different, but in fact, these two inequalities are equivalent in the classical case. And we can also consider the case where this transmissivity is not a half, and we have the same kind of statement, the average input entropy is a lower bound on the output entropy. And throughout this talk, I will focus on this kind of version mostly. but the proofs are more or less analogous. Okay, so are there any questions? If there are, please interrupt me. Otherwise, I'll just spend a few minutes reviewing some basic definitions of continuous variable quantum information. If you know about this, you can not listen for a while. Yes? Oh, well, I mean, if you think of this as an addition of x plus y, then, I mean, it's not quite concavity, because if you write out this expression, it has square root of lambda times x plus square root of 1 minus lambda times y. But that's true. Yeah, I mean, it's just the terminology, but in some sense, what matters is the average of the input entropies. Well, you take the convolution of random vectors. So it's a good point. I mean, the addition is a bit strange, but that's what people say when they talk about this kind of inequality. It's a concavity inequality for the entropy or for the entropy power. But you have to say with respect to this addition. Okay. So. So what about continuous variable quantum information? So let me be very brief here. Let's consider first a harmonic oscillator, a one-mode system. Then the Hilbert space is, of course, infinite dimensional. It's spanned by number states, which are the eigenstates of the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian. These mode operators Q and P, they satisfy bosonic commutation relations. So this is all standard. And then if you talk about states on this Hilbert space, they have a description that's somewhat similar to probability density functions. So there's a so-called characteristic function, and you can write any state in terms of its characteristic function as an integral using these displacement operators. So that's just a convenient way of specifying states, and part of the reason why I'm introducing this is to define what a Gaussian state is. A Gaussian state is simply a state that has a Gaussian characteristic function. So the characteristic function is a function on phase space. It depends on momentum and position. And the Gaussian state has a Gaussian characteristic function. And the same story applies to multiple modes. Suppose you have n modes, then we just have two n pairs of canonical position and momentum operators. And again, you can express any state in terms of its characteristic function. just one example here. Suppose you have two oscillators, and you consider a state that's a tensor product between the first one and the second one. Then the characteristic function has the form you would expect. It's just a product function. So it factorizes the first variable just contains position momentum for the first oscillator, and the second one, position momentum for the second oscillator. Okay, so now what about operations? Let's consider unitaries. What you can do is you can consider the Heisenberg picture and consider what happens to the mode operators when you act with this unitary. So, and of course, the resulting operators will again satisfy canonical commutation relations, because we just apply the unitary. So what that means is that if we expand these new mode operators in terms of the old ones, then this matrix S is a 2n by 2n matrix. This has some constraints. It will be a symplectic matrix. And so in some sense, you should think of this as a restriction on the set of physically allowed unitaries. But it also gives you information about the unitary. This matrix tells you how this unitary acts on the mode operators by conjugation. But it turns out that this description is actually complete for a subset of unitaries, the so-called Gaussian unitaries. For such a unitary, you can actually express the action on any state in terms of this matrix S. And that's just the formula. So you get a new characteristic function in terms of the old function and this matrix S. So just to give you an example that's probably familiar to you, this is just a beam splitter. In this case, if you have transmissivity a half, the symplectic matrix is, takes this simple block form. And if you look at the Heisenberg action on the mode operators, you see that the new mode operators on the first mode are essentially just the sum of the two input modes. So this suggests that this is sort of the right addition law in the quantum case. You should just consider one of the output modes of a beam splitter. Just to give you a little bit more motivation, let's apply the rule that I gave you before to a product state. So I said product states have product characteristic functions. If you now apply this symplectic matrix and the rule that we had, then you get this kind of non-product function. So this is the characteristic function that describes the output state of the two modes and the output of the beam splitter. And now we are going to trace out one of the modes. For characteristic functions, that's just integrating out one of these canonical variables. And when you look at this expression, you see that what we have here is essentially a convolution of characteristic functions. So here you already see that there's a similarity between this kind of addition law and the classical case where we take the convolution of probability distributions. Okay, so more generally, let me now introduce this quantum entropy power inequality. So the addition law that we are considering is given by this picture. This is a beam splitter with transmissivity lambda. It's described by this symplectic matrix. And we're just going to discard one of the output modes. And now the entropy power inequality tells you something about the output entropy in terms of the input entropies, just like in the classical case. So here's the statement. On the left, we have the average of something that looks like the entropy power instead of H, the von Neumann entropy. The Shannon entropy, we have the von Neumann entropy S here for quantum states. So the average of the quantity E to the von Neumann entropy is a lower bound on the same quantity for the output mode. So this is the claimed entropy power inequality. And as I said, I will show you what this implies for capacities. So this is for transmissivity a half. And then I told you that there's a different version in the classical case that doesn't deal with exponentials. Actually, let me just mention a difference here. Maybe you've noticed a difference to the classical case. Maybe not. Here's the difference. In the classical case, we had a factor of 2 in these exponents. And so somehow, I mean, there's a way you can sort of explain this factor intuitively. If you think about a quantum degree of freedom, it has two canonical classical degrees of freedom associated with it. So the phase space is two-dimensional. So if you apply this classical vector version to sort of this two n-dimensional vector space, this two drops out, and then you get this inequality. But this is not how we're going to prove it. I don't know whether you can prove it along these lines. Okay, so let me now just give you the other version. This is for beam splitter with transmissivity lambda, and it says that the average input entropy is a lower bound on the output entropy. And, well, in the quantum case, these two versions, we don't know whether they're equivalent. We have proofs for each of them, but we don't know how they're related to each other. So it appears that the first one is somehow stronger in applications. Okay, so in the rest of the talk, I will just show you a plot about capacities, and then I will try to explain the proof of this kind of inequality. So are there any questions about?
So is the classical entropy power addition in some sense a limit of the quantum one? Like, I don't know, for a strong current state?
I guess so. Yeah, we haven't considered that, but I guess it should be the you should be able to obtain it as a limit. But we haven't tried. That's a nice question. Okay, so so here is just one plot that shows an application. What we're considering here is the capacity of a thermal noise channel. It's shown up here. Its environment has mean Fossil number 2, and the plot here shows the capacity as a function of the input photon number. So in the continuous variable case, you have to impose an energy bound on the ensemble to get meaningful statements about capacities. So this is this axis. And what the plot shows is basically a lower bound. So this is the this line at the bottom by Holewell and Werner. So this is obtained by considering an ensemble of coherent states. And then there was an upper bound that is in the same paper. It's just the maximum output entropy. So that's neglecting the second term in the Holewell information. And then we have a new upper bound from bottlenecking. That's just essentially the capacity of a pure loss channel. It's just some argument. But then if you apply the entropy power inequalities, you get these two bounds, and one of them, the one from the first version, is actually, as you can see here, pretty close to the lower bound. Okay, and if you want to know more about this sort of stuff, you should look in that paper. Okay, so let me now explain what's involved in the proof of this kind of inequality. And so this is kind of a long story, but a lot of it can be found in classical papers, as you will see. And essentially, I will mostly just talk about the classical case and show you how you can adapt this at the end. So the proof that I'm giving here is sort of an adaptation of classical proofs that are adapted in a way that allows us to generalize it to the quantum case. Okay, so here's an illustration for the classical case. What we are interested in is the entropies of these three random variables, x, y, and the addition of x plus y. But this is sort of hard to understand. X and y can be arbitrary random variables. So what we're going to do is we're going to let x and y diffuse. And what happens is that these distributions become nicer and nicer. So in this limit, they will all be Gaussian. They will actually have the same entropy scaling. So in this limit, in this large diffusion limit, the entropy power inequality is sort of trivially true. Yeah, so to do that rigorously, you have to understand the asymptotics of this diffusion process and so on. But in this limit, we understand it. And then what we're going to do is we're going to try to extend this argument backwards, because we want to say something about this side here. And the way this is done is by studying the differential change of entropies as we diffuse. So we just consider diffusing for an infinitesimally short time and show that the certain derivative is negative. That's all. But this will take up some time. Okay, so here are the three elements. First one is this diffusion. Then there's a connection between diffusion and entropies and this so-called Fisher information. And then the third thing that we're going to use is a convexity inequality for Fisher information. So this looks like the entropy power inequality, except that the inequality goes in the opposite direction and it's for a different quantity. So I will tell you about each of these steps. So the first step is perhaps very simple, but it's extremely important. So this is this smoothing argument. So instead of considering x, we just add a random variable with normal distribution and variance t, and then we let t go to infinity. And what happens to this distribution is that it will become simpler and simpler. And I will just show this, draw this kind of circuit diagram for this process of adding a normal random variable with variance t. Okay. Maybe you've recognized what this is. This is just the heat equation with this initial condition on the left. So somehow the heat equation plays an important role here, which is quite nice, I think. And this is what I told you. If we look at this large diffusion limit, large time limit, then the distribution sort of doesn't depend very much on the initial conditions. In particular, you can show that the entropy doesn't depend on the initial condition. And that sort of implies that the entropy power inequality is satisfied in that limit. So just to make this precise, this is what we're going to do. We're going to let X diffuse and Y diffuse, and then we're going to let them through the beam splitter, through this convolution in the classical case. And it turns out that this convolution has a nice compatibility property with this diffusion. You can either let the inputs diffuse or let the output diffuse. So these operations commute. And the reason for that is that all of these are essentially convolutions. So that's the intuitive reason why this works. But what this tells you is that this random variable that's obtained by adding up the diffuse versions is essentially something that's obtained by letting a random variable diffuse for time t. Yes? It is, yes. There will be a version later on where it's different. But it's not diffusion, it's translation. Okay, in that case it is. Good question. So, and that's actually important because it tells you that all these entropies scale in the same fashion, which I told you before. If you were for a different amount of time, then you would have a problem with that part. Okay, and this is what I said. It implies the entropy power inequality in this limit as t goes to infinity. And now we have to understand what happens sort of in between. And to do that, one introduces a function which essentially quantifies how much we might be violating the entropy power inequality. So if this function is non-negative, you know that the entropy power inequality is satisfied for this time. And we know that it satisfies in this limit, this function will be zero in that limit. What we want to show is that it's non-negative for t equal to zero when we have no diffusion. Okay. So these are the two properties. That's what we want to show. We know it's zero at infinity. So now that means that it's enough to show that this function monotonically decreases. We have something that's zero on the far right. And if it's monotonically decreasing, it must be non-zero or above zero on the far left. Okay, so this relates. So this means we have to understand the derivative of this function. So this differential change of entropies as we let this diffusion act. And in fact, instead of showing that the derivative is negative or less than zero for all times, it's enough to consider the time, well, the initial time. And that's because this diffusion is a semigroup. So you can take the derivative and sort of compute it very easily. And that's just the circuit diagram. But that's the detail. So we only have to understand the derivative of this function at time equal to zero. Okay, and that brings me to the next topic. And this is de Bruijn's identity. And essentially what it does, it re-expresses this derivative in terms of what's called Fisher information. So maybe you've seen this before. What is Fisher information? Well, this is an estimation theoretic concept. So suppose we have a family of probability distributions that's parameterized by some unknown parameter theta. So for example, you could have a distribution that's translated by some amount that you don't know. I will draw this kind of circuit diagram for that. And what you would like to estimate is how much you learn about this parameter if you get an observation of this random variable. Or say 10 observations. And well, and that's what Fisher information does. Here's the expression. It's some derivative of these probability densities squared and integrated. Well, this is maybe not very helpful. What matters is essentially this case where we have an unknown translation. In that case, you can express the Fisher information in terms of the original distribution and its derivative. So it sort of depends on how distinguishable these distributions are for different values of this unknown parameter, how much they overlap. And that can be made more precise. I'll do that later. Okay, and again, well, the relation to estimation theory is called the Kramer-Rau bound. I don't think I have to go into this. It's just maybe you've seen this. It gives a lower bound on the variance of an unbiased estimator. But we're actually not going to use this property. Oh, in this, that's how we're going to use it, but it doesn't need to be zero otherwise. Oh no, it's independent. Okay, so why am I telling you about Fisher information? Well, let's just go back to what I told you before. We're interested in letting a distribution diffuse and then computing the differential change in entropies in this process. But then I told you about something else, which was translating the distribution, generating a family of distributions and pretending that we don't know this parameter theta. And in that case, we're interested in the Fisher information. And well, it turns out that these quantities are the same up to a scalar, and this is called de Bruijn's identity. So this is a nice relation. I will not go into the proof of this, but essentially what it does is it uses partial integration and the heat equation. Okay, so now we have a way of computing or re-expressing these derivatives in terms of Fisher information of translated families. That's classical, but we have a quantum version. Okay, so now let's just apply this. So how do we get from the entropy power inequality to a Fisher information inequality? Well, you just apply the rule that we had before. I told you that it's enough to consider this function and show that its derivative is negative. And if you take the derivative at time zero, you just get this Fisher information inequality. Okay, so now it seems like we haven't done very much because this looks essentially as complicated as the original statement with entropies. But that's not true because we know a lot about these Fisher informations. So now I'm going to tell you how you can prove this kind of Fisher information inequality. So these are the properties of Fisher information that we're going to use. The first two are sort of trivial. So if you reparameterize the family of distributions, then you just have to multiply this Fisher information by the Jacobian, essentially. So in the scalar case, you just get a scalar multiple. You can also consider families of product distributions of independent random variables, and then this quantity is actually additive. So these two are just useful tools for computing Fisher information, but the really important property of Fisher information is this data processing inequality. So what it tells you is that if you process your information, you only lose information. So you shouldn't process your information. For example, you shouldn't throw away your information. It's processing. So that's a very important property of Fisher information. Actually, it's sort of the justification of calling this information. Okay, so how do you use this? And this was found by Zamir in 98. It's a very nice proof of this Fisher information inequality. All we want to do is we want to apply this data processing inequality. And the way you do this is you just look at the right-hand side. I told you that this is the Fisher information of this translated family that you get after adding up X and Y. But now we have, again, a compatibility between addition and translations, just like we had a compatibility between addition and diffusion. So it turns out that you can equivalently translate the inputs and then add them up. But in this case, you have to use different amounts of translation. That's just a detail. So to understand this family of distributions, you could try to understand this side. And of course, what this is a family of product distributions that is processed by this addition operation. So if you just compute the Fisher information of these product distributions, then you get the quantity on the left. And this is just data processing because this addition is data processing. Okay. So that's essentially the proof of the classical entropy power inequality. So we had all these elements. We needed diffusion, which was compatible with convolution. It was also compatible with this Fisher information by de Bruijn's identity. We also needed translations, which again were compatible with this convolution or addition. And so basically, these are the concepts that are involved. And this Fisher information, the most important property of it was that it satisfied data processing. Okay, so at this point, I guess I could end the talk and give this as homework. It should now be pretty easy to generalize this to the quantum case, especially, for example, the translations. You might already guess what these are going to be in the quantum case. So we'll need some concept of diffusion of quantum translations and quantum Fisher information that that all have the desired compatibility properties. I don't know how much time I have. Okay. So maybe I'll continue. So let's look at this inequality. So this is just an illustration of the proof now. So now instead of probability distribution, we're considering the Wigner functions. So these are just the Fourier transforms of the characteristic function. And as you see here, the same kind of thing works. We have some kind of diffusion process that I'll define, which brings these closer and closer in some sense. And we can extend this backwards then to get a statement about these three states. Okay, so let's start with the analog of the heat equation. And here it's useful to think about the classical particle and its phase space. So we have position and momentum. And if you use these variables, you can think of the heat equation just as a diffusion in phase space. So that's what the heat equation looks like. And of course, you can rewrite this using the Poisson bracket. And once you do that, you can just use the Dirac quantization prescription, replacing Poisson brackets by commutators and canonical variables by canonical operators. And what you get to is a quantum diffusion equation. And I should mention that this kind of equation was used by Hall to analyze sort of classical Fisher information in a quantum context. So now I could tell you how you solve this equation and analyze the asymptotics of the entropy and so on. But instead, I'm just going to continue. So let's so that fills in that box. We have this Markovian master equation with this Liouvillean. And now I have to define what it means to translate a quantum state. Well, of course, so that's the classical thing. In the quantum case, we're just going to use displacement operators, because when you act with them on mode operators, they just translate the mode operators. It's given by this identity. And then we can define translated families of states by translating either in the position direction or the momentum direction. So this is going to be the quantum analog of translations. Okay, so there's one thing left, which is this Fisher information. And well, somehow this expression is not very helpful to think of generalizations. But I told you that the main property of this measure is that it satisfies data processing. So maybe that's a way to get a result. In fact, in the classical case, it's known that this data processing inequality uniquely specifies the Fisher information. There's no other information measure with the same properties. So you might hope that you could use the same kind of characterization in the quantum case, but PETS has shown that, in fact, there are infinitely many different such monotone metrics in the quantum case. So there's no unique quantum Fisher information. So clearly this approach doesn't work because we don't know which one we should use. There are too many. But it's actually very simple. So I told you that the Fisher information, the classical one, you can think of it as a measure of how much these different distributions overlap or how similar they are for different parameters. And you can make this precise by introducing the relative entropy or divergence. And then the Fisher information is just the second derivative of that quantity around a certain point. So you just look how much this relative entropy deviates as you move around in a neighborhood of a point. And it turns out that the first derivative is zero and the second one is this Fisher information. So that's an alternative definition of classical Fisher information. And it's clear that we can generalize this one. We can just use the quantum relative entropy and use the second derivative and define this as Fisher information. And you can show that this quantity is indeed a Fisher information. It satisfies data processing, basically because this relative entropy is monotonic under CPTP maps. Okay, so this is the complete list. And the rest is details. So you have to verify all these properties. You have to check these compatibilities between the beam splitter and diffusion. That's very simple because the whole thing is a Gaussian operation. The same is true for these translations. They are compatible with the beam splitter. It's easy to check. Then you have to understand the asymptotic scaling of the entropy as you let this diffusion act. So this can be done using upper bounds that come from the so-called maximum entropy principle. So you can just consider Gaussian states, and there's a lower bound using Q functions. I won't go into that. The Bruin identities is simple, and data processing follows from the properties of divergence. Okay, so let me end with an open problem. So I told you about a version in the quantum case for the beam splitter with 50-50, for the 50-50 beam splitter where we have equal transmissivity in X and Y. But you could try to extend these arguments to apply to a general beam splitter for all lambda. So this version of the entropy power inequality, we only have it for the 50-50 beam splitter. And classically, this is true with twos in the exponent, but we don't know how to prove this in the quantum case. And perhaps I don't really know what the estimation theoretic expression interpretation of that quantity is. So I think there might be something similar, like Fano's inequality. So these are just two open problems. If you want to see the implications of such a result to channel capacities, you should look at that paper. Okay, so that's it. Thank you.
Quantum Fisher information in terms of the second derivative of the relative entropy. Does it give you a bound also on the unbiased estimation?
You mean like a Kramer-Rauter bound? Yes, I think so. I mean, this whole family of Fisher informations are related to estimation theory. There's a nice review paper by Petz.
Okay. And also, I'm curious about that uniqueness result. Under what condition this Fisher information is unique?
I think this was shown by Chenkov in the 60s or so, and what he it's a Russian Chenkov. He considered the manifold of parametrized probability distributions.
And not a single parameter.
There's also multi-parameter generalization.
If it's multi-parameter, I don't think there will be a unique because. At least you can look at the Fisher information of each of those parameters, and each of them is non-increasing under information processing. So it can be.
I mean, I'm not too familiar with the multi-parameter characterization, but I think it should be fairly unique. I mean, in the scalar case, it's just a scalar multiple. That's the degree of freedom you have.
And you say if you find any other parameter like mutual information, or it can be written as a function of the.
I guess I wasn't very precise here, but it's not, I mean, mutual information also satisfies data processing, of course. But what you want here is something that tells you, if you look on this manifold and you're at a particular point, so you're considering a particular distribution, you want to know something about when you move away from that infinitesimally. And for that purpose, you want the metric on this manifold. And this result about Fisher information is actually a statement about the metrics. And this Fisher information is sort of, you can use it to define a metric, and that one's unique. So, so that wasn't completely precise, but.
Questions? So let's thank Robert again.